This is Out of Line After Hours with John McElroy and Gary Vasilash, episode 403 for December 15th of 2017. What did James Bond drive? We ask Mr. Aston Martin. Watch Out of Line After Hours live at outofline.tv every Thursday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. That's 12 p.m. Pacific. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Out of Line in iTunes, Stitcher, or YouTube.
Out of Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion, and by Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems.
Mr. Vasilash, we're back in my favorite place, you know, in the studio on the Out of Line After Hours.
I've got to say, though, so last week we were virtually in Malibu because that's the Mustang show we did last week. Yeah. And then the week before that, we were physically in L.A. and did the L.A. show.
Right.
So here we are back at the studio. And what did we get last night? Like half a foot of snow?
Yeah. Right. We got a winter storm for sure.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, we got to let everybody know Dave Sullivan from Out of Pacific is also in the studio here with us.
Thank
Great
you for
having
me back. Thank you.
As we do. But our special guest today is Simon Spruill, the Chief Marketing Officer for Aston Martin. And it's awesome to have you on the show here. And you've brought a DB11 into the studio with you here.
Yeah, I'd love to leave it behind for you.
Oh, well, thank you. You can do that.
Yeah, but it looks good. No, new V8 as well. So one of the first V8-powered DB11s off the line.
Yeah. So we got a lot to talk about with Aston Martin. And Simon, it looks to me like a company that has been near death for decades and decades is really starting to turn itself around. You've got a new CEO, Andy Palmer, who you worked with at Nissan. But bring us up to speed in the last 24 months or so, because it seems to me that Aston's really turned a corner.
Yeah, so I think you track back the journey to late 2014 when Andy joined in October. I joined a month later in November. And we set on a path together with the management team, so Marika Design and the other members of the executive team, to look at the next, effectively create a midterm plan for the company. When we arrived, the DB11 was well on its way. The Vantage was starting its preparation. So the Vantage is the car that we announced a couple of weeks ago. But what was missing, arguably, was what was beyond that. So, and how you sustain. So you alluded to the fact that Aston's had somewhat of a, let's call it a roller coaster ride over the 104 years of its existence, and it's had some real highs, but it's also had some real lows, and it's been through different owners along the way. So the important thing for us to do was to stabilize the company, was to set it on a sustainable business track so that it starts to generate money through operations to fund its own product development as opposed to keep going to mum and dad for handouts. And so that led us to create the Second Century Plan, which we launched in Geneva Motor Show in March of 2015. So that was Andy's first big Geneva as a CEO. That was also the launch of the SUV concept, so DBX. And that, in a sense, was the symbol of the company's future revival, I guess. So DB11 along the way, Vantage to come. And then what we said is over the course of the 7 years, we'll do seven cars. And that's the renewal of the current range. And then that's the growth into new segments, most notably the SUV, a mid-engine sports car, which is coming off the back of our project with Red Bull and Valkyrie. And then the rebirth of a second of the two brands in the portfolio, which is Lagonda, which comes at the end of the plan. And so the idea is that you create a product lineup with a shorter replacement cycle. So as opposed to where we were, 10 years for each car, bring that down to the industry average of about 7 years per car. And then you get into new segments and you replace cars quicker and generate more business that way. But don't grow too fast and don't grow over, obviously, what the market can absorb.
But you mentioned the SUV, but it seems to me that Aston Martin is the purveyor of fine sports cars, and you guys have been doing it for more than 100 years now. And so this car that we have, the DB11, now when it was introduced, the CEO, Andy Palmer, said that this is the most important car in the history of the company.
Yep.
Why?
if you think about Aston, probably, I mean, sports cars are the things that come to mind most, that's the top of mind, and DB. So if you think about the centre of gravity of the company is sports cars, and the centre of gravity within the centre of gravity is DB, and of course DB coming from David Brown, who bought the company in 1947, so immediately after the war, he acquired Aston Martin and Lagonda, so that's where you get the DB lineage from. And if you think about what defines our brand, a certain British secret agent, but also the DB lineup, and probably the connectivity between Mr. Bond and Aston is DB5. So the epicentre of the brand, how we're judged as a company, is what we do with the DB lineage. And, of course, DB11 came along, replaced DB9, which was a much-loved car. And DB9, at its time, also signalled a revival of the company because it came off an all-new architecture. This was a car that was still developed under Ford ownership. It's when Uli Betts was CEO and so on and so forth. So DB, for us, has always been a kind of bellwether to the health of the company. So when you've got also a new platform, you've got new powertrains, you've got the electrical architecture from Daimler, another new relationship for the company. So everything came in on DB11 as being, OK, is this company going to be on track for recovery, or is it just a kind of one-car show? And DB11 set us on a path which is now continuing with Vantage and so forth. So that's why DB11. And it was the first new car that came out under Andy's under his leadership as CEO of the company. So naturally, there was a lot of him in the car as well.
You know, you mentioned that secret agent, so I thought it was interesting that on the website there's a description of the company. And so there's an opening paragraph, and then there are these subheads. One subhead is ownership, product range, racing pedigree, Newport Pagnell, which I probably mispronounced, and the final subhead is James Bond. So I can think of no other car company in the world that would literally have James Bond associated with them, so or anybody else for that matter, so very,
yeah,
very closely,
I mean,
associated.
We live in a world with a lot of brand ambassadors. In fact, we, you know, as you may know, we now work with people like Tom Brady. We've got the guys in Formula One, so Daniel Ricciardo, and of course Max Verstappen. But there aren't many brands that are associated with a fictional brand ambassador, and one that's had the longevity that we have, and it's probably the, I would say, the longest, most enduring relationship between a brand and a fictional character. I mean,
1964, Goldfinger.
Yeah, exactly that. So, and we've been in
24. Is it going to continue?
We hope so. Yeah. I mean, we Eon, the owners of the Bond franchise, have announced a new Bond is coming.
Right.
Daniel Craig has signed up to be to play James Bond. We're one movie at a time. We work with the producers, and if there's a fit for us, then it's great for us to be in the franchise. I mean, it's a great part of our heritage, naturally.
You know, I'm interested. You talking about the Lagonda brand? I remember going back, I don't know, 30, 40 years ago, there was the Lagonda sedan, very advanced for its day. Maybe too advanced for its day. I don't think it worked very well. But I didn't realize that the official name of the company is actually Aston Martin Lagonda Limited.
Yes.
And now, as you're talking about this new plant that you've got in Wales, and you're going to do an SUV and what, another sedan, right?
It'll be, so in St. Athan, starting end of 19, early 2020, will be the Aston Martin SUV, which we based off the DBX concept that we showed at Geneva in 2015, and two other products to follow, which will both be Lagondas, which will be in that large sedan and SUV segment of the market. Principally, Lagonda is the part of our business that will compete most directly with Rolls-Royce and Bentley.
Okay, so Aston Martin's going to be the traditional more sports cars,
more sports
and Lagonda.
Yeah, exactly. And Lagonda will go in
true premium luxury.
Yeah, I would say that it's just different because one isn't above the other. That's the most important thing, and that's how in the company we look at Aston Martin Lagonda. We look at, it's a bit like JLR, right? What isn't higher than the other? They're two companies within one group. We look at Aston Martin in the same way as Aston Martin Lagonda in the same way. You've got two companies, both of which are doing different things in the luxury market.
Are we going to get Lagonda here in the U.S.?
Yes, absolutely. Okay. I mean, when we bring back the brand in 2021 with the first of the all-new cars, it's going to be a global brand, absolutely.
So to John's point, just to be clarified, so the Lagonda will be more of a traditional sedan architecture.
Yes.
And Aston Martin will be a sports car and the SUV.
Yeah, if you think
of that. And the SUV looks pretty much like a sports car from the drawings that
I've seen. Yeah, I mean, the concept, obviously, I mean, the tough part about the SUV market for all of the luxury brands, and you've seen Bentley go with the Bentayga, Lamborghini recently with the Urus, Rolls-Royce are coming with theirs. You know, we'll come in last and best dressed with the Aston Martin, with the DBX. So we the inherent challenge there for particularly brands that are based off a sporting lineage, so probably more of a challenge for Bentley, Lamborghini, and us is how you keep your DNA, but you translate that into a product that inherently is a higher ride height, a higher H point, it's bigger, needs to be much more functional. So that's a challenge. But you know. Having seen what Marek did in only a few months when Andy gave him the challenge, I mean, when Andy came in October of 14, I think his second day on the job was to say to Marek, I need an SUV concept for Geneva. You know, that's like 4 months away. So that's like, you know, making a wedding cake in 2 hours or something. I mean, it's crazy. So, but Marek pulled off, I think, something of just beautiful proportions. And that's then helped us understand the design language for an Aston Martin, how that translates to an SUV. I mean, if you look at an Aston, what you're seeing is the two-thirds-third proportion, and you've got an A pillar that goes very gently down into the centre of the wheel line. So we're not cab forward; we're always sort of sat back. So how you retain classic Aston Martin proportions while doing an SUV is obviously a big challenge for the design guys.
Yeah, I mean, you look at, like, the Bentayga. It doesn't have that long dash-to-axle ratio that... Exactly. And it looks a little weird to me. I mean...
Well, I mean, I wouldn't say anything about our competitors, but what I would say is we're focused on making the most beautiful SUV in the world, and it needs to instantly look like an Aston Martin and have the design edge. The advantage that we have is that we're not encumbered with a carryover platform. So the architecture that underpins DB11 is our architecture. That architecture then gets adapted for Vantage, that gets adapted for Vanquish, and then leads into
so it's not, nothing from Daimler?
No, nothing at all. It's all our architecture. What we take from Daimler is the electrical architecture, so HVAC, nav, and so on and so forth. In this particular car, and in the Vantage, has the twin-turbo 4-litre V8, which is the AMG engine, but that's it. Architecture, and if you look at the body in white, you'll see that's all Aston Martin.
Okay, back to James Bond for a moment, because Jim Evans wrote in to ask. In Skyfall, the James Bond movie,
yep,
the bad guys destroy Bond's original DB5. Without giving away too many details, how did the movie guys pull that off?
I probably get shot by Eon for. I believe there was a lot of creativity around the final shoot, because it was the blowing up of the Skyfall house, wasn't it? And that's the car got consumed. As you saw, though, I think if I'm right, Inspector, the car was restored, and I think that was the final shot of Spectre, was BMT 216A, which was the original silver DB5. Was reborn. There you go. Right. Yeah. It's tragic, isn't it? But
yeah.
I can say, well, one of the things that marks out Bond movies is that they actually don't use a lot of CG. They do their own stunts, which is why it always looks so incredible.
Yeah.
So when you see a car going up, I let's let some of the magic remain magic. But yeah, it's distressing to me to see a DB5 on fire.
I mean, a lot of the talk these days too is about, you know, Brexit. Is that, you know, in terms of, you know, a brand that's set to introduce a lot of new products and hopefully have some growth, is that, you know, is that a potential hurdle next few years for you?
Yeah, so when going into the Brexit debate, we took a very different stance to the other automakers in the UK in that we didn't cast our vote in either direction. So we Andy, very early on, and very smartly identified that this was, in the end, going to be a personal decision for people to vote. So Brexit was a whole bunch of different things that were going on in the UK at the time. And Andy said, look, I'm not going to come out and tell our employees, make our employees feel pressured to vote one way or the other. There were clearly advantages and disadvantages for going both ways. We ended up with Brexit. So how do we now deal with that? Well, the biggest issue that we face is uncertainty over trade. There has been a short-term benefit of Brexit, which is the pound has weakened.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that's helped us as we're an exporter. We're 80% plus of our volume is exported, so there's some benefit there. There is some counter to that in that we're bringing in powertrains from our factory in Germany, buying ZF transmissions and so on and so forth. So there's a little bit of exchange there, but bottom line, if you're an exporter, a weaker currency is naturally a little bit better. We've seen the pound strengthen a little bit as the path to Brexit has become clearer. But what we've been doing with the government and with the rest of the auto industry is focusing on, A, get to an agreement quickly, give us a clear path, but work on trade. And that's the most important. That's not just tariff barriers. So is there going to be an import duty put on Aston's going to Germany? Well, if that's the case, probably there's an import duty going to come on, you know, BMW's right. coming into the UK. So that's hopefully a tit-for-tat that won't happen. Probably of equal or more concern is non-tariff barriers. So are there going to be, you know, is there going to be a slowdown in the ease of getting of exporting a car into Europe? We believe common sense will prevail in the end. All of the car businesses in the UK are very highly export-driven. So, and the auto industry in the UK has had a resurgence in the last 10 years. There are tens of thousands, millions of jobs riding on it. So it's an important business, and we're all pushing in the same direction for clarity, and particularly clarity on trade.
Hey, let's talk about some of the ownership of the company, because mm-hmm. what I'm intrigued at is Daimler owns 5%
yep.
of Aston Martin. You're getting AMG V8 mm-hmm. engines from them. You're also now teamed up with Red Bull Formula One Racing. In fact, the team's going to be branded, right? Aston Martin Red Bull.
Yep.
Red Bull is trying to kick Mercedes' teeth in Formula One. And I'm just intrigued that you guys are able to play with all these different, very fierce competitors and seemingly being able to get away with it.
Yeah, I think you can, in a sense, it's a proxy for the entire auto industry, right? Because there are so many interconnected relationships between all the OEMs and race teams and suppliers and so forth. In the end, what takes place on the track is between Red Bull and is between Mercedes. Yeah, we don't run the race team. Christian Horner, Adrian Newey, Jonathan Wheatley, Max and Daniel, they're the ones that are putting it down on the track, and they're doing everything they can to beat AMG, to beat McLaren, to beat Ferrari, and Godspeed to them. We hope they win every time. That's racing, and that's how it should be. And we are in F1 off the back of the Valkyrie program that we're doing with Adrian Newey. That's given us then the entryway to set up, for example, a new joint engineering and design center at Red Bull Racing. So there's an Aston Martin center there. Off track, business is business. And Daimler came in at a point in time when Aston Martin needed, you could say, a big brother to help with technology, to help with some powertrain options that we were looking at the time. The V8 that's in the DB11 here that goes into the Vantage, great fit from the AMG family. And then of equal, perhaps more importance, was the electrical architecture. And that was a decision that was made quite late in the day relative to the DB11 program, and the program had to effectively be halted and we had to re-engineer to integrate the Daimler architecture in. But now we're set on a path where we're using a very high quality, Star 2.2, latest generation Mercedes and Daimler electrical architecture in the cars. And that's business. You know, they're not giving it to us for charity.
Mm-hmm. But why are they even helping you out? Because that is helping you a lot. Even just selling it to you is a big help.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, look, you'd really need to talk to Dieter and the Daimler board about what was going on in their heads when they made the strategic decision. All I can say is that from Aston Martin's point of view, we, as a small independent company, we are somewhat dependent upon a network of suppliers that can help us with our business. So, you know, I reference ZF for our 8-speed transmissions. We work with, on this car, it's wearing the Bridgestone sport tyres, developed specifically for D11. I'm looking at Brembo brakes there. So we work with the best in the industry. The electrical architecture that we had under Ford ownership was a derivation from Volvo and other Ford systems that were put in. We needed a clean sheet of paper. We needed latest generation technology.
It was getting old.
Yeah, I mean, it had reached a natural conclusion of its useful life in a product, and the next generation needed to offer a lot more functionality. And so we were going to have to go to a tier one supplier. It could have been Bosch, it could have been anybody. Daimler came along with a total solution that included access by negotiation to other parts of their business. So when we're looking at next generation cars and we say, well, we need an X or a Y, we can go to Daimler and say, do you have something that could fit? That's a pretty good position to be in for an independent company.
Yeah, very much is. Hey, we've got to take a quick commercial break. I'm so glad that you mentioned that the DB11 here is sitting on Bridgestone tires, because we now have to give a shout out to our good friends at Bridgestone. Okay, we're back talking with Simon Sproul from Aston Martin, who just pointed out that these tires, by the way, have 007 branding on them.
It was Bridgestone's branding for the tire. The S007. developed for. So again, I mean, we're a small independent manufacturer, but we are able, I think, because of the brand and because of the performance that we offer, to work with some really big, serious tier one suppliers. And Bridgestone have been a terrific partner on DB7, and they developed this tire for that car.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned the Vantage, which was just basically introduced last month. I mean, that you guys announced.
The new Vantage.
The new Vantage. That's right.
So tell us about the heritage. I mean, because so much of this company, I think, is about heritage, as well as it's about the future. But I mean, again, you guys have such a great past that cars like the Vantage, I mean, has come through time. So tell us about that.
Yeah, Vantage. Well, Vantage as a nameplate was created by David Brown back in the early 50s, if I think I've got my dates right. And it was actually a higher performance version of the standard cars, if you can have anything like a standard Aston Martin. Vantage lived through, so you get DB5 Vantage, DB6 Vantage. Vantage became its own nameplate in the late 70s, 80s. It's probably going to be historians fact-checking this.
Oh, yeah.
Pulsing you with...
They're going to nail you.
The owners' club are going to be nailing me on everything here, so forgive me my sins if I forget any dates. But Vantage became, and the V8 Vantage, in fact, if you talk to Andy about what car was on his bedroom wall as a kid, it was a V8 Vantage. And in fact, it's a car that Andy owns now as part of his growing Aston Martin collection. So the Vantage nameplate became its own car in the 80s. And then the biggest volume car that we've ever had has been the Vantage, and has been the current model Vantage. And that was the car that was launched out of Gaydon in, 2005? So it was the first Gaydon car. So Vantage came first, then DB9. I think I got that right. And Vantage has been with us in the current form for about 10, 11 years. So replacing the Vantage for us is a big deal. And this is, if you like, our volume or our entry point to the brand. So the new Vantage comes in, all new architecture, coming off the DB11. AMG twin turbo V8, but adapted for our use. So we mount it much lower in the car. We tune it differently, so it's different driving characteristics. It'll come with a manual transmission.
Amen, brother.
Yeah,
amen.
Yeah. So you have to thank the boss for that, because Andy's a transmission engineer when he started out in his career, and one of the first things he did when he joined the company back in October of 14, is he went to the US and he met the dealers, and he said to the dealers, what do you want? And they said a whole bunch of things they're after. And one of them was they wanted a manual transmission car. So he said, right. So in fact, we brought back the V12 manual into Vantage for the current model. So it's the only brand in the world, I think, where you can buy a normally aspirated V12 with a three-pedal gearbox, which is pretty cool. And when we were making the product decisions for the new Vantage, we looked at PDK and we looked at all kinds of other transmission options. And we took a different route from the others. We've gone for, at launch, a ZF 8-speed. It's a beautiful gearbox. It's what we use in the DB11. Much sharper paddle shift. So if you choose to do paddle shift, it's got a much more sports-tuned paddle shift. But within about a year, we'll introduce a manual version of the... I believe it's the only application where you'll be able to drive that engine with a manual transmission, because I think Mercedes only offer it with an automatic.
Yeah. You mentioned volume. You've got to tell us about what volume production is for Aston Martin, because it's fairly astonishing.
So if we take a step back, look at the luxury business in totality... there are six players. So there's Aston, McLaren, Ferrari, Lamborghini, Rolls-Royce and Bentley. And we're all somewhere currently between 4,000 or 5,000 units a year and about 9,000 units a year. So, which is, I know, which is you know, which is a day's production here in Southeast Michigan.
Right. It's like F-150 for like 10 minutes.
Yeah. For 10 minutes, right. So you know, we take our time. And the Gaydon factory is capacitized to 7,000 units a year, which is the right size for a profitable but exclusive sports car business. Ferrari at about, what, 9 and change, and they've, I think they've got some ideas to go above that. Lamborghini probably are about to increase because of the Urus.
Ooh.
Bentley are on an increase. We're going to go on an increase as well. So actually all of the luxury players are set for growth, but relative to the auto industry at 90 million units a year, it's
your new plant will be able to make how many?
So the new plant in Wales is going to be capacitized to 7,000 units a year as well. So we have two manufacturing facilities, Gaydon, which will be sports car center, and then we'll have St. Athan, which will do the Aston Martin crossover and the two Lagondas.
Okay, we got a phone call here. Let's take that from Jonathan. Then we're going to have to get to Dr. Data, too, but let's bring that phone call in.
Hey, guys. Jonathan out in Old Japan, New Jersey. Just wanted to say that Aston Martin is sex on wheels. Holy crap, what a beautiful car. Thank you very much. Great show.
Thanks for the comment there, Jonathan, and we agree with you on that one, too.
Thank you.
But, hey, let's, you know, at this... Usually midway through the show, we always take a break to get the latest number from Dr. Data. So it's time for Dr. Data.
Okay, so as I mentioned earlier in the show, you're trying to read off my thing.
No,
I can see you're trying to cheat. All right, Carmen, please bring the first number up. And so I'll give you a slight clue. And this in some ways has something to do with Simon's past in some ways, but so the number is approximately 240, and the image in the background gives you a clue. It's a blue object of some sort, and any idea what 240 might be?
How many Model 3s have been sold?
Close. John?
I'm going to guess that's how many days Simon spent at Tesla.
It wasn't quite that many.
and your guess, Simon?
I don't know. I mean, when I see 240, I was thinking of Datsun, but no, I don't know, actually. No.
So actually, before the day before yesterday, Carmen had done the slide, and it was approximately 140, and I had to change it. Sort of on the fly, or actually she had to change it. But so the answer is the number of Tesla semis that have been pre-ordered. And wow. So what changed it all up was when Pepsi pre-ordered 100 units.
Uh-huh.
So I should mention that Simon had a stint working with Elon Musk.
Right.
And but it was also interesting. So yesterday there was another electric semi basically introduced, the Thor truck. Have you heard about this?
Oh, if that's the one I'm thinking of.
Pretty ugly.
Hideous.
Yeah.
Oh, there it is.
Ugh, that's okay. Hideous. Oh, my God.
Looks like some sort of...
Doesn't it look like like Transformers or something?
I don't know.
It looks terrible. So this is basically the Thor is going to start at $150,000 for a 100-mile version, all-electric vehicle.
That's cheap.
Yeah.
Well, I say that because a Class 8 tractor right now is about the same price with a diesel engine. So to be able to do it all electric for about the same price?
100 miles, though?
Well, 100 miles is not a lot. No, I agree.
I mean, if you're Pepsi and you just have a route where you're delivering around.
Yeah, but Pepsi's going for the 300-mile Tesla, which is $150,000.
If you're Pepsi and you have, you know, your truck that goes to Meijer and then Kroger and then wherever, you know, the grocery stores. And
no, trucks like this, 100-mile range, you're talking about the Port of Long Beach.
Yeah.
You know, which has got a huge pollution problem, and you just got to run to the warehouse that's not that far away and make several runs a day, and you're done.
So does Aston have an electrification program?
Yeah. So every car that we produce by mid-next decade will be hybrid or electric.
Plug-in hybrid.
Well, we're looking at all the different technologies at the moment. I mean, that's partly legislative pressure, but partly because we think it's the right thing to do. We will actually be the first luxury car company. So amongst our our six rivals, will be the first luxury brand to bring an all-electric car to market. And that actually comes out in 2019. So we're doing an electrified version of the Rapide, which is our four-door model. We're working with Williams Advanced Engineering. So we just love working, working with Formula One companies. We're working with Williams to do that. And that's a special model. I think it's going to be very collectible. It's 155 units, and it's a great way for us to show that the Aston Martin brand can adapt and take electrification. And I've driven the prototype, and it's so elegant. And it's you know, you worry about the sound, which is really a part of our DNA, and that's true. However, brands have to evolve. And actually, the sound of silence is almost just as elegant. So, and in a car like the Rapide, it really fits very well.
I'm laughing here as you say that, because again, you know, you've got this deal with Mercedes, but you've got this branding thing going with Red Bull Formula One. They're kicking their teeth, and now you're going and having Williams Formula One do your electric car.
Yeah, when we're in the paddock.
I love how you guys can pull this off.
Yeah, we do breakfast with Williams, lunch with Red Bull, and dinner with Mercedes in the Formula One paddock.
No. Well, and then you and Andy Palmer.
hopefully, they all like us.
You and Andy Palmer used to work at Infiniti, right?
Yes, we did.
So there's that as well.
Yes, yeah, we know the guys at Renault as well. Yeah, that's right. No, I mean, the F1 paddock is often feels like a sort of get-together of old friends. Look, we're very lucky. I mean, the UK has developed over the years a F1 as a speciality. And if you look
it's at... It's an industry.
Yeah, totally. And if you look at what they call the sort of motorsport valley or motorsport triangle, what is it, five or six Formula One teams? So Mercedes, Red Bull, McLaren, obviously, Williams, I've Force India, plus all the suppliers that go towards Cosworth and so on and so forth. So you've got an industry that's grown up. So for the OEMs like us that sit within that space, why wouldn't you use the expertise at hand on composites and lightweighting and advanced...
The best engineers working with the most bleeding edge of technology.
Yeah, absolutely. So there's a sort of, you know, it's not just because we like working with Formula One teams, that's where the expertise is.
You know, I have to ask, I mean, what... Everybody wants to talk about luxury in China these days. Mm. Is that going to be your biggest market, or is it your biggest market?
No, it won't. It won't. The United States is our biggest market, and will I think will continue to be our biggest market, just because this is simply the biggest luxury car market in the world. Even though China has eclipsed it in as a bigger car market in totality, China for us, we were relatively late starters in China, and over the last 24 months, we've restructured our business, new management team, new dealers, and of course now new product. And China is quite. The engine size has a big impact on your sales, which is why you see, you know, V8 engine Ferraris and so on and so forth.
Because of taxes.
Right. So the car here, the V8 DB11, big breakthrough product for us in China. What's interesting is the V12 DB11 Coupe has been very successful, way ahead of expectations in China, and actually a very different demographic. So we're seeing 50% of our buyers in China are women.
And bodes very, very well for you.
And young as well. So, you know, I was like, what did I do right? bottle it up and sell it. But I think the fact is that China is taking on an affinity for luxury cars. Clearly, the SUV boom is going to drive the volumes even further. But what's encouraging is that a new coupe like the
DB11. So is 14,000 vehicles a year capacity enough?
You don't want to overbuild. No. So that's why Gaydon, we took the decision to capacitize Gaydon to 7,000, or rather to not extend Gaydon to produce more sports cars than 7,000.
So you guys aren't in the, like, we're just going to make as many as we can.
No.
No. Still because, want to keep it.
Because you want to preserve, it's a balance of exclusivity. Yes, you want, obviously, a sustainable business, and we've mapped a sustainable business that is 7,000 sports cars a year, plus up to 7,000 other products a year.
That's one shift?
It's one shift.
So, see, this is why they invented overtime. If you have to go a little bit more, you can probably get a little bit more.
You pay the bills at that number, that's
Well, what you then focus on is revenue per unit. So it's not just about volume, it's about what you're getting for each car. So the luxury business also does very well in personalization and customization and special projects like Zagatos and so forth. And you've seen our luxury competitors do very well out of that business. Aston over the last 3 or 4 years has made a very, very fast rate of climb on special projects, so much so now that they're baked into our cycle plan of 2 special vehicles per year, and those products are derived from our core products, or can even be something completely different like Vulcan, which was, or can even be a recreation model as we're doing with the DB4 GT. So specials, so every build slot, you want to maximize the revenue of those build slots.
Keep going with their conversation, because now Aston's getting into other things that are not automotive whatsoever. And why? What's the vision? You're aligned with boats. You're aligned with buildings.
Yep, that's right.
And other luxury goods. Yep. And you're not the only one doing that. Ferrari's doing much of the same thing. Well, where's this all going with luxury?
So I think you can say that the across the luxury sectors, so whether that's handbags, perfume, whatever it might be, luxury is diversifying, and luxury brands are getting into new product segments. So that's a first trend. Within the car business, you have seen, you referenced Ferrari's got quite a healthy business in non-automotive, so brand extensions. We looked at the business. We didn't want to get into mass manufacture of baseball caps, but we did see a growth business in high-value, so boats, even submarines. Working on a submarine.
Really?
Yeah, real estate. So areas that complement the lifestyle of our owners. But that sounds very marketing speak, but that effectively is what it is.
I would love to have done the market research on that. Submarines.
The submarine was I say came out of the blue. It's a bad joke, but we were approached. So we developed the AM37 powerboat with Quintessence. We were approached by Triton, which is world's leading manufacturer of personal submersibles, and they came to us and said, we'd love to do a really cool submersible line with you guys. And we took a look at it, and Marek got involved, and we launched it at the Monaco Boat Show. And, you know, a really high level. Now, we're not going to produce hundreds of submersibles, but a few with the right design aesthetic, with a business case that's, you know, don't forget, this isn't, the other thing to remember here is there's two reasons to do this. One is to keep my CFO happy. So it's going to be good for the bottom line. And the second is it good for the brand? So we don't just rush to put Aston Martin on everything.
But it's not just goods. You're getting into experiences as well.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, you can come away on vacation with this if you want to. So we offer, I mean, we sell a product that it, by its very definition is an experience to own and to drive. Yeah, I mean, you know, all of us in the luxury business are selling something that is based on desire, not necessarily on need. And it's a very natural extension to that to say, come and do interesting things with us on your cars. And that's what owners want to do. You know, they buy the car, but then they say, well, what am I going to do with it? You know, so giving people an opportunity to do, for example, go ice driving in New Zealand. That was a big hit last year. Next year, we're doing ice driving in Japan. So come away with us and, you know, learn how to drive on ice and have a holiday in Japan. Why not? You know, there's a lot of great roads in the world that are on people's bucket lists. Attending 24 hours of Le Mans, going to Monaco for the Formula One race. So you look at all the different things that people now want to do as experiences, and we can open that world of Aston Martin and have people come and join us.
I think it's fascinating.
So how do you control the essence of these things? I mean, how do you make sure that they're Aston Martin and they're not just some tour company?
So that's where Marek...
Marek Reichman.
Yeah, so Marek as Chief Creative Officer has... he and I work so closely together on all of these projects. And, you know, if you think about defining what feels good and what feels right and what feels wrong, it's a debate inside the company all the time. Because you can imagine we get a lot of proposals. You know, we want to do an Aston Martin this, that, or the other. And there are some we were like, yeah, I don't think we're going to do a refrigerator or, you know, whatever it might be. So but there are, we have the debates all the time within the company. And Marek, as Chief Creative Officer, has the casting vote on that. And he as the guys in charge of the design team to create the cars, which is the brand, you know, we exist for the cars. He is best placed to sort of say, you know what, that feels right or it doesn't feel right. Which is why when we look at, you know, the powerboat, the M37, it's what you would imagine, hopefully, an Aston Martin powerboat to look like.
Plus, every designer wants to do a boat.
Yeah, and you've seen a lot of them. I mean, you reference real estate. I mean, you know, we live in such an interesting world that Aston Martin and Porsche are in competition with each other in Miami in the real estate market. Porsche are building or involved in a residential project in Miami, and so are we. And the Aston Martin residences in Biscayne Bay kicked off last year. We broke ground this year. It's 301 apartments, ranging from about 650 through to about 50 million. And the interiors and the common areas will be designed by Marek and the architects. And having seen the plans, it's sensational. It's beautiful. It's very elegant. It's very classy.
Did you pick one out?
that's a tough conversation I want to have with Mr. Palmer. But no, I mean, I think if you look at where we want to take the brand, and inevitably beyond just cars is
right. You're saying the whole luxury market be your playground.
Within reason, and it's knowing when to stop. That's the key. Mm-hmm. And you know, I'm sure there's many commentators out here, and we're going to be flooded with lots of emails saying, I think it's probably a test of what you say no to as opposed to what you say yes to. Mm-hmm. But we are testing the boundaries. I mean, you would have thought us doing a real estate project would have been a flight of fantasy. But us, Porsche, Fendi, Bulgari, Bugatti, we're all in the real estate business.
Mm-hmm. You know, you talk about limits. Quick question.
Yeah.
What is the lower limit for Aston Martin in terms of vehicles?
Oh, we're at it with the Vantage.
That's it?
Yeah.
And what's the starting?
$150,000.
Yeah, for the new.
So that's the entry level.
Yeah, we went into a lower segment with the Signet. You may remember that was a car that was developed for the UK and Europe, and that was
A Toyota.
Was an IQ, but actually, so here's the irony of Signet. It was the program didn't fulfil its potential. However, the Signet now is incredibly sought after as a classic car. Yeah, absolutely. They're worth more now than they were when they were new. So, you know, if you get off
the
Signet...
It's an IQ with a beautiful interior.
Well, you know, it was painted in Gaydon, in the same paint shop that did all the Aston Martins. It was trimmed by the same people. So, now, was it the right decision? I mean, history will judge. But it marked a segment that we went into for a specific set of reasons at the time. The company and the business has moved on, and we wouldn't go into that segment again. So we see Vantage at 150 as the entry point, as a natural entry point to the brand.
Hey, now I do have to cut everybody off. We have to take another quick commercial break and give a shout-out to our good supporters from Lear.
Lear Kinexus offers a parental controls application with geofencing that sends notifications regarding driving behavior and location, including curfew alerts, acceleration alerts, and speed alerts, all delivered to a smartphone application that includes vehicle location, driver notifications, and a report card of driving history, including notifications when predefined geographic boundaries are crossed. For more information, visit Lear.com.
Hey, we're back talking with Simon Spruill from Aston Martin, and we got another question here from the audience. Raffy325 wants to know, were you involved with and how important are vehicles like the Aston Martin DP100 Vision Gran Turismo for PlayStation?
Just a little bit before my time. So Marek did DP100, which was a challenge that Gran Turismo gave, I think, to all the car manufacturers, saying, come up with a sort of no-holds-barred vision. In fact, you've got something over your left or right shoulder there, John, which is the Red Bull no-holds-barred race car. So DP100 actually was a really cool project for the design guys because it allowed them to explore some very different form functions. And actually, if you look at it, it's a mid-engined or virtual mid-engine configuration, which is kind of interesting because Valkyrie is the first mid-engine car really that we'll do, except for the Bulldog. I know the historians will check me on that one. But really the first series production mid-engine car for Aston Martin will be the Valkyrie.
So DB100. When's that coming out?
Well, Valkyrie will be first deliveries will be 2019, and then that that starts the DNA, the bloodline of a series of mid-engine cars that goes through to the fifth car of our seven cars.
How long does it take to make one of those? It looks amazing.
It's a race car. I mean,
Valkyrie, yeah, it's hundreds of hours. Yeah, the average time to make a regular car.
A regular Aston Martin.
Yeah. 20 hours, yeah.
A regular Aston Martin.
No, a regular Aston Martin is about 200 hours.
Okay. 200 hours.
Yeah, 200 hours.
But you mentioned that it's largely handcrafted, yes, that you have a couple robots in your factory.
Yeah. Paint shop, body shop, that's it. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Let's talk about the Valkyrie a little bit more. I'm intrigued by this. I mean, this looks like you could drop it down on the track at the 24 hours of Le Mans, and I got to believe that's part of the plan. I read some article that Andy Palmer would love to see a rules change that would allow these exotic sports cars to actually race.
Yeah, I mean, there have been over the course of the last few years a number of these very high-performance, ultra-exotic and very expensive cars coming from all the luxury players, right? Valkyrie was a project that was born out of our desire to do a hypercar. Adrian Newey, who we knew well from our time working with him at Red Bull, he wanted to do a car. The planets aligned, and we could do it together. The cars will be, some will go away and be stored and nurtured and never see the light of day. That's sometimes what happens with collector's cars. We hope not many of them. We hope most are driven, and certainly there's a lot of interest from those that are buying Valkyrie that they'd like to be able to get it out on the track. Now, we
got a picture of it up on the
yeah, that's hand. It. I mean, it's just a remarkable.
What's it going to cost?
So we're a little coy on the final price because it depends on your options, but it's well north of $2 million.
And powered by?
A bespoke 6.5 litre Cosworth developed V12, normally aspirated. Ooh. V12.
Now, will the engine be built by Aston Martin?
By Cosworth.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, but working with us and Red Bull.
So, I mean, this just sort of looks like a Formula One car with a body on it.
Yes, I mean, if you take what everything that Adrian has wanted to do, Adrian's the most successful Formula One designer in history. He's won more Grand Prix than anybody.
Yeah, the car just looks. I mean,
yeah.
That's what I was wondering. How long is it?
Two-seater.
It is
road legal.
Unreal.
It is. I mean, it's an incredible project to be part of. Incredible supply.
You'll make how many?
150 of the road cars. That's the road car.
Okay.
And then we'll do 25 track-only versions, which will be even more extreme. And we showed a preview of that last month. So, yeah.
I think we've talked about pretty much every, you know, you guys have your hand with, you know, Red Bull, Cosworth. I mean, now I just need you know, maybe something with Lotus, and you'll be pretty much have to deal with everybody.
Well, I think again, the British motor industry is kind of interesting. I mean, it's ever innovative, and it's not that dissimilar in a sense to the big three here in Southeast Michigan, where there is a network of suppliers and small shops with specialty skills and so on and so forth. So, and because of the size of Aston Martin and how fast we're moving and how entrepreneurial we're trying to be with the business, naturally that's leading us to work with people that are experts in different fields, and it's great. I mean, it's, you know, Andy is leading a team that is doing very different things with the brand that's never been done before, and he is, from his track record, you'll have seen that he understands how to build very strong partnerships.
Mm-hmm.
And we like working with other people.
Mm-hmm.
It's December. How's your year looking in the U.S.?
Really good. I mean, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, sales,
like Bentley sales are not doing so well this year. So I won't.
No, we're good. I mean, we're benefiting from the launch of the new DB11. So, and then we've got Vanquish coming as well. So sales are up. Well, double digit. I won't do the final numbers because we wait until the year's done before we disclose. But sales are heading in a very healthy direction.
Good.
Simon, you mentioned one of the competitors is McLaren, and McLaren makes the comment that all of their cars are made with carbon fiber. That's their stock and trade. Is there something similar for Aston Martin, or is it just horses for courses and you use the materials that are best suited for the application?
Yeah, I think more of the latter. I mean, we don't use much steel in our cars. So all of the, well, particularly the you know, ourselves, McLaren, probably Lamborghini and Ferrari, all tend towards more lightweight materials, composites. So if you come to Gaydon to see our body shop, you won't see a lot of sparks flying. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a very quiet body shop. Yeah, there's some very impressive dow adhesive, structural adhesive at work, and that's one of the very few robots we have in the factory. So we're bonding and riveting architectures primarily out of aluminium castings, carbon fiber upper bodies, for example, on Vanquish. So we use the optimum material for the right application. Valkyrie, as you would imagine, carbon fiber all the way.
Sure.
And lots of unobtainium that Adrian keeps insisting on to keep the weight down. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah. It'd be cool to see the LMP2 category, say, evolve into something that would accommodate a car like the Valkyrie.
I think there's going to be a look, consumers want to see the hero cars on the track, and they want to see cars on the track that they can also see on the road. Mm-hmm. And while prototype racing, I think the recent history of LMP1 has been really exciting with all the manufacturers getting involved. It's sort of done its full circle, it seems. Now you've only left with one manufacturer.
That's right.
So that sort of seems to have passed its peak, at least in its current form. So enabling cars like Valkyrie, AMG Project One, the McLaren Senna, the Enzos, the FXXKs, those exotic hypercars that have been developed, allowing them to get on the track and have fun, why not? You know, we're in the entertainment business. Right?
We usually only see them just sitting. You know, you don't get to see them going around a track.
I mean, motorsport is for fans, not for manufacturers. Mm-hmm. That's why we do it.
Right. Hey, you've had a fantastic career in the auto industry. I think you started at BMW.
Ford.
Oh, you started at Ford. Did you spend any time at Ford? So Ford, and that was with the Premier Automotive Group primarily, right?
Yeah, part of it.
And then you went from Ford to where?
Nissan.
And then spent a long time at Nissan.
Yeah,
in fact, you worked a lot with Carlos Ghosn, right?
Yes, I did. Yeah.
How's it working with Carlos? What's it like?
I think I've been very lucky in my career to work with some pretty interesting CEOs. So I was lucky enough to work a bit with Mark Fields when he ran PAG. I was obviously very lucky to work with Mr. Ghosn. I can't call him anything else other than Mr. Ghosn. It's a reflex. And it was at a point in my career where I was plunged into a global job at a fairly young age in Japan, and was trying to keep up with the boss. And it was a tremendous experience. Mm. And Andy and I both came from that incredible period of Nissan turnaround and growth and expansion and the alliance and so on and so forth. So, you know, we were both very lucky to be part of that. And then on, obviously, through Tesla and then to Aston.
So, what was it like working with Elon Musk?
Again, great. I mean, you know, when you have a seat at the table or just one step back from people like, Mr. Ghosn or Elon, it's a real privilege. And this industry is so fascinating. We're all students and devotees of the industry. So to be able to get inside the heads of some of these leaders and understand how they tick and see how they make decisions, mm-hmm. it's a real privilege. I mean, there's one defining characteristic is all of them have an incredible ability, Andy included, is to make very complex situations simple and focus on the right thing to do. That's a real skill.
So I got to ask you too. You didn't spend very long at Tesla. Did you leave because you were pulling your hair out, or was it the opportunity to go to Aston, or how did that happen?
Yeah, it was very simply the opportunity to go to Aston, and I think not unlike the product, it's obviously a very emotional decision at the time, and Aston was at a point in its development where it was, on the brink of needing that turnaround, and Andy called me up and said, "Hey, guess what?" And then history followed. So it was obviously a difficult decision at the time to make, but ultimately to be part of Aston, I mean, it was a great privilege to work.
Look, you're English. It's an English company with a lot of heritage that needed a lot of help. And so it was kind of a calling, as it were.
Yeah, I think that's a very.
And you grew up with posters on your wall of those cars, not of.
Absolutely, still do.
Yeah. So to the point of, we can't let this Tesla thing go. From your point of view as a student of the industry, do you think his effect on the industry has been outsized in some ways? That it's just an enormous impact for such a small company?
I think it's incredible. I mean, if you look at the manifesto that he wrote when he started the company, actually, if you just take that, and this is not my opinion, this is fact, if you take what he wrote and what he intended to do, he's achieved that already, which is to catalyze the transition of the auto industry towards zero-emission mobility. I'm probably missing a couple of words in there, but that's the essence of what, in his original manifesto, he set out to do, and it's happened, and it's happening. So if you take a step back, one guy who's affected that change on an industry that large and entrenched is incredible. And that's probably... I'll stop there.
Yeah. Okay.
So a safe place to stop.
Yeah. Okay, but so you know, as John mentioned, you've worked with, you know, Williams and Daimler and Brembo and just on and on and on. Why did those companies not make that disruption? Why do you think it came out of Northern California?
Boy, I think you have to look at how he communicates and the vision that he gives to the world. And I think that's automotive, that's space, that's now tunneling.
Boring.
Right. I mean, you know, so we live in an age, not to get too philosophical about it, we live in an age where innovation is really interesting and stimulating. And I think he embodies some of the most interesting thinking in innovation in areas perhaps that were industries that were not advancing or changing at a particularly high rate of knots. The fact that the car industry is now sexy because of the intersection of, if I call it Detroit and Silicon Valley, and the car industry is now hot, and, you know, I've been in this business 25 years, and the car business is a really exciting place to be.
What's sexy is that. Yeah. It has nothing to do with electrification.
No, but I would agree with you.
This is, again, this is the cool thing about our industry is there's still... amidst all the autonomous drones and blah, 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 there's still a place where beauty and craftsmanship is appreciated. In fact, I think it's going to be even more highly prized in the future.
I agree with you on both those counts. It will be more highly prized in the future. And I totally agree, too, that the auto industry is sexy again. It's a cool industry to get into. And as recently as 5 years ago, I don't think you could have said that.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah.
Real good. Well, look, we've burned up an hour here, and we ought to wrap up this show now. I know we had other topics that we wanted to get into about the automotive industry and latest in news, but this has been way too interesting. So, Simon Spruill, thanks so much for taking the time to come on Autoline After Hours. You've been an awesome guest here.
Cool. It's great to be part of the show. Yeah. It took us 104 years to get here. Yeah. We finally made it, right?
That's right. Dave Sullivan, always good to have you on board, too. Yeah, so great having you here. And Gary?
Next week, it's presents and coal.
Presents and coal, because Christmas is right around the corner.
It is, so got to
see. So we'll do that then, and of course, we invite all of you to join us then.
AutoLine After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion, and by Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday afternoons. Get your daily fix with Autoline Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline This Week. There's all that and much more at autoline.tv.